this next week. I deliberately chose them to suggest some views that you would not likely see in some of the main environmental type of literature. These are contrarian views, and I agree with some of them. I don't agree with some of them, but I think they'll get you thinking about some of the issues, and that is our topic for next week. I goofed on the assignment, and if you'll copy out the assignment here, let's see, for next week, and I'll get some questions to you later. This is the first year we've tried this particular assignment to look at the whole question of honesty and reporting and looking at views of this type, and I'll be interested in how it actually works out. Okay, we're coming towards the end of the course, and I'd like to try to begin to tie some issues together. It's become very evident so far that we cannot talk about how we should treat the environment without talking about ourselves. And it's also become evident, I think, that in talking about ourselves in this context, we raise fairly basic questions, not just trivial questions about adjusting to this or that, but really very basic questions about how we understand our own existence and what is the broadest framework within which we live. We raise questions, for instance, such as the question, is survival the ultimate human value? And if not, what other values might we be living for? Barry Smith, a recent master's student that I had, did a very interesting thesis on some of the sociological dimensions of environmental action groups. I'd like to make a few quotes from his thesis. He wrote in one place, he said, when nature is the ultimate referent, every American is a sinner. Every ride in the car, every styrofoam package, every BTU from fossil fuel, every laundry load is a step away from the sacred center and a step towards eco-calamity, which is the environmentalist's deepest fear. To destroy nature is to destroy not just a biological reality, but a social reality that is at once ordered, meaningful, and sacred. That's fairly strong language, but I think quite provocative. According to Barry Smith, in a society where traditional social and religious values are widely questioned and even rejected, that is, in a society in which, and I quote him again, the sacred canopy is lifted, nature fills the gap. Personal suffering and insecurity then become more bearable because they are part of a larger historical narrative. The suffering of nature, its need for protection, and the moral fellowship of the environmental movement. He clearly sees the more radical forms of environmentalism as a kind of moral religious crusade. He says, just as the Christian can find life meaning in sharing the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ with his neighbor, so the ideological environmentalist finds herself participating in a sacred crusade that gives her life meaning, that helps her life become an adventure worthy of commitment, sacrifice, and devotion. He notes, and again I quote, the core value of the environmental ideology is sustainability. Those who deny the moral system of the environmentalist are alien, even dangerous. Those people who don't see these problems, who are not concerned about sustainability, are enemies. They are dangerous people. If the ultimate referent of human existence is God, then nature still is very important, but it's more likely that environmentalism will take on a more pragmatic flavor and will be less moralistic and spiritual in orientation. I'm very interested in that aspect of Barry Smith's work, because it seems to me that one of the most acute problems we face in doing environmental policy is that it so easily becomes diffused with and permeated with ideology that we lose our common sense in many cases, and we settle for fairly extreme solutions. There is a kind of ecofascism. There is a kind of misanthropy. Those who talk lightly of somehow reducing human population from 5 or 6 billion to maybe 600 million at least in the very near future, seem to me to be people one wants to watch very carefully, even if, as is the case for myself, I believe that overpopulation is a very serious problem. I don't think the right-wing critics who say that we can just ignore population, that we can go on expanding our food resources and so on, are correct. I think the population issue is a serious problem, even though technically I think it's possible that we could feed as many as 15 or 20 or even 30 billion people. I think that might be technologically feasible. That appears to me to be an extraordinarily dreary prospect for the future, that we would more and more find our freedoms limited, the availability of open space and wilderness and nature experiences almost non-existent. So when I hear that kind of issue discussed in that way, I shudder. Yet at the same time, I find myself somewhat near the position taken by the author of Green Delusions, that there is a good deal of ideological fantasy as we look at some of these issues. Thus, I would argue that we need to take very pragmatic positions when we look at specific issues. What actually works? What most adequately preserves our deepest social values and still helps us make progress in dealing with the environment? I can remember 20 years ago in a paper that I never published. The idea seemed too radical at that time. I was playing with this idea of combining social justice and concern for environmental integrity. And I coined at that time what I call Bayer's garbage principle. Did I mention that, Jim, in an earlier lecture? I don't think so. And it seemed to me that one of the issues we face is precisely the issue that first world nations are polluting and overstraining the environment a great deal more than so-called third world nations, and that there is a certain fundamental injustice in this if you think of the environment as a common. And so in thinking about that, I recalled the fact that we have things like the silver rule and the golden rule, and one of my philosophy professors even coined what he called the aluminum rule, which he said was light and portable and adaptable to the modern age. The aluminum rule was, don't let others do unto you what you wouldn't do unto them. Fairly practical in some ways for politics. And as I was thinking about this, it did seem to me that one could start with a principle something like this, that you don't have any more right to throw garbage on my lawn than I do on your lawn. And insofar as we all throw around some garbage, that is environmental pollutants, you don't have the right, in the second formulation of the principle, to throw any more garbage on my lawn than I do on your lawn. And if you took that as a kind of starting principle of distributive social justice, I'm not altogether serious about this, but partly serious, it would have some very curious results, because the fact, of course, is that first world nations are dumping an enormous amount of garbage on other people's lawns, that is, on the global environment, and this seems to be fundamentally unjust. And as I thought further about this, it did seem to me that one could take that principle and start with something like pollution entitlements, that each person would get, say, 100 pollution entitlements, either for a lifetime or, say, so many per year. And then if your lifestyle were such that you needed more than that, and most of us in the modern Western world would need 5 times that much or more, you would have to purchase these from third world people who are not producing as much pollution. Incidentally, I just saw an article almost identical to this within the last 2 or 3 years, and it made me a little bit angry that I didn't push some of the publishers a little harder to accept this piece. The piece didn't seem to appeal to anyone 20 years ago, 25 years ago when I first wrote it. So that if you wanted to pollute more than your allotted share, you would have to purchase these, and this would do 2 things then. It would be a source of distributive justice. It would increase funds available to poor people who were placing less strain on the environment, and it would put a pressure on rich people to pollute less. Now, don't ask me if I think there's any chance of that being implemented soon. I don't think so. But I think it's that kind of more ultimate principle that at least can stretch our imaginations about what justice on a global scale might look like. This is also related to my conviction as a Christian that there probably is no fundamental reason why any human being deserves any more disposable income than any other, unless you can show, in a kind of Rawlsian sense, I refer to John Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice, that by having unequal incomes, everyone, including the worst off, is better off. Rawls makes a very persuasive argument in A Theory of Justice that if you permit the kind of incentives and so on associated with unequal income up to a point, that everyone seems to be better off. That the experiments in radical egalitarianism, such as Marxism, have not seemed to work very well. So again, here would be a radical principle as a kind of ultimate ideal. I don't think that any one of us innately deserves to have 2 or 5 or 500 times as much income as anyone else. And yet, on the other hand, I support a kind of market system, a kind of capitalistic structure, because I think empirically it has shown itself most capable of producing wealth at a sufficient level that everyone's life situation appears to be better than under the socialist Marxist experiments that we have seen. Now, I mention those simply because as we look towards specific solutions to environmental problems, I think on the one hand we have to think bold thoughts. We have to look at justice principles that really are far-reaching. These are 2 fairly far-reaching principles. Bear's garbage principle and the affirmation, whether right or wrong, that I find little justification from a Christian standpoint that any one person deserves larger disposable income than any other. I think that as sort of ultimate ideals, those would have a lot of influence or could have influence on how we look at specific issues. Can they be translated into policy in the near future? Of course not. Not in any simple sense, without, I think, excessive cost and confusion and chaos. So what I'm arguing for is that on the one hand, we think bold thoughts of justice and equity and environmental integrity, and on the other hand, that we think very pragmatically about what actually works. And I think we can look at many cases where certain aspects of laws such as our Endangered Species Act and laws that deal with air quality and so on have not been well crafted in terms of how they actually work. It's my impression from the reading I've done that, for instance, and I did mention this, I believe, in an earlier lecture, it would be far more rational in dealing with air pollution to target those 8 to 10% of automobiles that produce over 50% of the noxious pollutants that all automobiles produce, and to deal with those before too quickly moving to extremely stringent regulations that have very negative effects on people in some of the poorer categories, people whose income is not as high. Let me give a second kind of, two or three other examples of a kind of pragmatism. I think we do have to concern ourselves with population growth, and I think it ought to be front and center as we think of foreign aid, as we think of aiding third world nations. And I would take a fairly strong position on this. I would argue that it is probably immoral for rich Western or Northern nations to give aid to poorer nations without strings attached. Because the experience we have had is that very frequently we have aided third world nations in such a way that has simply strengthened right-wing dictatorships, that has permitted them to avoid the tough economic choices, that has in many cases resulted in greater social injustice, so the rich get richer and the poor poorer. And it would seem to me that, for instance, as we're thinking about foreign aid, and I believe the rich nations have a very strong obligation to share some of their wealth, I would like to see the rich nations eventually commit 2 or 3% of their total domestic product to foreign aid. It seems to me as we think about that, there ought to be at least 2 very specific strings attached. That is, that no aid would go to any nation that did not make a very solid commitment to work for greater distributive justice. That is, that they would work to knock down some of the tremendous differential between rich and poor. We should not be involved in foreign aid that just makes the rich poorer. We ought to give it with that string attached. And that secondly, we should not give foreign aid if there is not some commitment to dealing with runaway population growth. The experience of being in a city like Cairo in 1954 when the population was about 3 million and being there about 3 years ago when the population was somewhere between 15 and 18 million is a frightening experience. Virtually all of the economic growth has been eaten up by population growth, and in many respects, it seems to me the people in Egypt are worse off today than they were in 1954. So here would be a very practical way of dealing with the aid issue. Now, some might say that's just patronizing and forcing our Western ways on other people. I would disagree with that because it seems to me that when adults relate to each other, they treat each other as equals and hold each other accountable. When you treat someone as an equal, you hold that person accountable. And if we're going to give foreign aid, it seems to me that it ought to involve at least those 2 strings. Now, there are many ways, of course, in which we ought not to meddle in other nations' affairs. One of my section students, Rumi, is doing a paper on some of the tremendous imperialism and coerciveness of foreign aid as he's seen it in Bangladesh, where he comes from. And I think we have enough horror stories of how Western technocrats have forced their will on other people to be very wary of that. But the other extreme of no strings at all, it seems to me, has not worked either. It has simply led to greater injustice in many cases and a runaway population curve. I would say that in case after case, we ought to be looking very pragmatically at what actually works, and if possible, to conceive of that also within a framework of large-scale justice considerations. Perhaps the most important point I would like to make in this connection is that I think our experience is increasingly showing that in many ways government itself is not the most effective agent in bringing about social change. Government can set the guidelines, it can help set the goals, but I am increasingly convinced that writers like sociologist Peter Berger and ethicist and theologian Richard Neuhaus, in their little book To Empower People, are more or less working along the right lines when they refer to mediating structures. Their theory is that in many cases we will more effectively deal with environmental problems and other social problems if government itself does not try to direct everything and actually operate all of the agencies and so on that wrestle with these problems. Some of the mediating and structures that Berger and Neuhaus refer to are family, school, church, labor organization, business organization, nonprofit, public interest groups, and so on. And their thesis is that government ought to provide a context that permits the growth of these groups, that encourages these mediating structures, and that in many cases they are far better positioned to actually bring about change than is government itself. And of course, one of the reasons for this is that such mediating structures that are not themselves a part of government are not bound by some of the constitutional limitations and limitations of what some refer to as liberal neutrality in the way that government agencies are. This is the problem, incidentally, that we saw in the Joseph Sachs book. I was talking with Carl Johnson on the way over this morning. He's taking a class where they're looking at the whole question of liberal neutrality and some of its impact on government policy. And Carl mentioned that in one of the last classes they discussed whether government even could or ought to run national parks if you take the idea of liberal neutrality seriously. And if I remember correctly, Carl, you said that the consensus in the class was pretty heavily on the side that they shouldn't, that already the idea of a national park involves going beyond liberal neutrality to a specific understanding of the good, and that if you take the principle of liberal neutrality seriously, that would seem to be illegitimate. This is one of the reasons why I think the Sachs book is so challenging, is that Sachs basically is suggesting that there is a moral ideal involved in the idea of the national park, and that we ought to take that very seriously. The parks are to make us better people in some fundamental sense. But if you believe, as some do today, that government ought to remain neutral among competing visions of the good, then how can you really justify things such as national parks? That's the point at which I think Berger and Neuhaus's work on mediating structures is so interesting, because family, school, church, labor organization, and so on do not have to deal with those particular limitations. The environmental nonprofit public interest group can unabashedly come out and work for a particular vision of the good. We see this in all kinds of organizations dealing with animal welfare, dealing with wilderness, dealing with wildlife, water quality, and so on. And they're able to do this, I think, in ways that are effective, that draw people into these organizations as volunteers, and that are very efficient at bringing about social change. So it would be my view that government's main role in some areas ought to be the role of encourager, not the primary role of doing all these various tasks itself. I get very, very nervous when people just immediately assume that if there's any kind of a social problem, if there's a problem with children or family or crime or anything else, that it's just assumed that this will be solved by more money and more government activity. Now, let me make a fourth point that on one level is very uncontroversial. On another level, I think quite controversial. And that is simply that as we wrestle with environmental problems, I think we do have to remember that everything is related to everything else. And it's my conviction that you cannot think of this just at the biological level. It's my conviction that only as we solve some of the non-environmental problems more effectively will we free up resources and energy and time to really deal with environmental problems effectively. And that's simply because our financial tax resources, personal incomes, and so on are not unlimited. So that in a certain sense, the kind of thing that Wendell Berry is arguing in his book, The Unsettling of America, The Gift of Good Land, and in other essays and books of his, I think is exactly right, that you simply cannot separate how we treat the environment from how we deal with other areas of our life. And here, in contrast to my earlier views about social justice, the garbage principle, and more egalitarian views of income, which might in some ways be categorized as liberal views, here I take views that might be categorized easily as more conservative. For instance, I think that it will be important over the long run, if we're serious about the environment, to rethink very, very basic social issues such as the role of the family. Here I will sound a little bit like Dan Quayle, but I won't apologize for that. I think that one of the most destructive aspects of current social arrangements is that many people have bought into the mythology that what people do sexually is a purely private matter. And I think we are gradually beginning to realize as a society that when you in some areas have illegitimacy rates approaching 90%, that we are in huge trouble socially. And it's my conviction that some of these problems are going to soak up so much of our total wealth in dealing with them that we're not going to have very much left over for dealing with environmental issues. I think we need to change our attitude. I think government needs to come to a position where we positively discourage single parenthood. I think single parenthood represents an enormous social injustice towards children. The data now is just overwhelming, it seems to me, that the child born to a single parent, the child who does not have the benefit of both a father and a mother on the scene, supportive, encouraging, and so on, that child is severely handicapped. Not in every single case, but if you look at it statistically, that child is in very deep trouble indeed. And I think if we're going to free up resources to deal with environmental issues, we're going to have to deal with that problem. I think we're going to have to change our thinking about single parenthood. Dan Quayle was right. Single parenthood is a great injustice to the child, and I think we gradually need to re-stigmatize single parenthood. I'm not talking about what happens after the fact in terms of personal relations with people and so on. I would hope they would be compassionate and supportive. But in a larger sense, I think we need to realize that this particular social experiment has failed. I think we're going to have to re-emphasize marriage. Marriage is not just a nice option. It seems to me it's very closely related to social stability and to the possibility of children growing up with benefits and without so many liabilities. I, incidentally, at breakfast today was reading a piece in the journal First Things. It's a journal of religion and public life. It was a little piece called Sex, Religion, Virtue, and Reward. And Richard Newhouse, who wrote the piece, made some very interesting comments. He for instance, pointed out the increasing case study data that suggests that overall the level of sexual satisfaction is substantially higher in marriages where there's a firm commitment to one another and a sense of the permanence of marriage than it is either in marriages without that commitment or in relationships where there's no commitment of that kind at all. He says even in just very, very pragmatic terms, people seem to be enjoying their sexuality much, much more in those kinds of relationships. He quotes one person here. He says, according to Dr. David Larson of the National Institutes of Health, greater sexual responsiveness among the faithfully married does not appear to be connected to any special sexual technique. Rather, it says here, he found, quote, that sexual responsiveness and satisfaction are significantly affected by the relational context in which lovemaking takes place. For this, the government funds research, one may be inclined to complain. But keep in mind that we live in an age when people are uncertain about, I won't go on, but he presents some very, very interesting data here that even in terms of very practical concerns, the marriage partners themselves experience a great deal more satisfaction where there's a firm commitment. Now, why do I stress this? I stress this simply because I think we are rapidly approaching a stage of social crisis in our families where we're simply not going to have any energy or time or money left to deal with environment. I think what is happening to children who are born to teenage mothers who don't experience the presence of their fathers and so on is becoming so that it's going to more and more absorb our energies and our money. I was really shocked last Sunday, driving back from Skaneateles. I hadn't taken the particular road through Moravia for maybe 6 years or so, 8 years. Here was a very large new prison just outside of Moravia. I don't know how many of you have seen it. And then as I came closer to Ithaca in North Lansing, a very large correctional institution for young people, I think women, young girls, I'm not sure. I hadn't seen either of these, and they came as a kind of cultural shock. I think we've reached a stage where we either begin to be more honest about these kinds of realities, or these attendant social problems are going to so fully engross us that environment simply will take a back seat. I think the evidence for that really is becoming very powerful. Charles Murray, in a piece about 6 months ago, suggested that he sees evidence that a change is taking place among poor white people that he thinks is very closely analogous to what happened among poor blacks and Hispanics 20 years ago. That is, he said the illegitimacy rate among poor whites is now up in the 22 to 26% range. And he says it was at that point that things really began to break down 20 years ago when it reached that rate among poor minorities. And he thinks that if that shift takes place among poor whites, and he thinks that's a very real possibility, that this will have far greater social significance simply because there are so many more poor whites than there are blacks or Hispanics or other minorities. So one of the things I would emphasize, I think if we're going to deal with the principle that everything is related to everything else, we're going to have to take a very hard look at whether so-called sexual liberation has worked or not. It's my view that it has not. I think Wendell Berry is exactly right, that fidelity in our relationships and in our marriages is going to have a very close connection to fidelity to the land. Let me take what may be an even more controversial position. I think we have reached a point socially where we are very much more concerned about creatures like the snail darter and the spotted owl than we are our own children. And I think people are gradually seeing the irony of this. I would take the position, for instance, that we ought to begin widespread censorship of material that is available to children. I think we ought to protect children from excessive violence, violence particularly against women and associated with sexuality, and that one can do this with perfect consistency in terms of the great classic liberal thinking about human liberties. John Stuart Mill, in his writing on liberty, is very clear that he's talking about liberties for people in the maturity of their faculties. I find it, and I've touched on this before in class, one of the most amazing ironies, in a sense, of our culture today, that we allow the sleaziest elements of our society to make a living exploiting children through the kind of gross violence and distorted human sexuality and so on that we expose them to. And it seems to me conceptually it's entirely possible to distinguish between freedom for adults and protection for children. Here I think the bias of the media is very apparent. How many of you are aware, for instance, I mentioned this in an earlier class, but the vote in the House just took place the last few days. The Senate voted 100-0 basically to tell Janet Reno to rethink her attitude towards child pornography, that she had it wrong. The media barely reported this. The House yesterday or the day before voted 400-3 to do the same thing. Three people in the entire Congress opposed this. One of the most one-sided votes in the last 50 years, and as far as I can tell, the media hardly report it. The Congress basically is saying, we don't want you to liberalize treatment of child pornography. We want you to keep prosecuting it and protecting our children in this way. Now, it's my view, and admittedly, I realize these are views you will not often hear at Cornell, that it is possible to go back not to the Middle Ages, but where we were 20, 30, 40 years ago, and again protect children from the kind of filth and destructive violence with which we simply inundate them today in the name of freedom. When people tell me they're doing this in the name of artistic freedom, I can only laugh at them. It is so utterly obvious to me that they're exploiting children for the almighty dollar. And it also seems obvious to me that people who say we cannot distinguish between children and adults are simply mistaken. The classical theorists like Mill, to whom we're indebted for much of our thinking about liberty, were able to make this distinction easily. And I believe we have to quickly move to a point where we are willing to protect our children in this way. I think we need to move quickly towards much tighter gun control than we have today. We need to protect children and people in the ghettos and poorer neighborhoods especially from the kind of random violence that is so very much a part of their lives today. Now, in all of these areas, what I'm suggesting is that everything is related to everything else. And that it becomes, I think, simply fantasy or illusion, in Iris Murdoch's terms, to think we're really going to solve environmental problems if we don't solve some of these other problems as well. I think if we continue to educate our children basically as consumers, if we continue to drum into their heads that rational behavior is self-interested, even acquisitive behavior, we will not likely make much progress on these other issues. I really hesitated whether to raise some of these issues because I don't much like taking the role of a moralist on such sensitive issues. But I did decide that if I'm really to speak honestly about what I actually think about these issues, then it's really not possible not to take the role of a moralist. And I think what is needed is open public discussion about these issues. I think we need to begin to insist that the media report these issues more fairly and that we resist the politically correct constraints of even refusing to discuss some of them. This does not mean, I would hope, that we move towards a kind of harsh position lacking in all compassion. I would rather think of this as a position that might be described as tough love, as compassion that really cares enough to do something about some of these very, very difficult issues that we face. I think this is also going to mean, as I've emphasized in earlier lectures, that we're going to have to be far more open with each other about what we really believe. I think the widespread disenfranchisement of religious Americans and religious views is unconscionable. I think the idea of liberal neutrality, as it works in writers like Ackerman and Amy Gutman and others, is pure fantasy. I think that when we actually look at how our schools and universities and government agencies operate, they do not operate according to a principle of liberal neutrality, but according to various visions of the good. Now, on the other side of that, that does not mean that the work of these writers is of no value. I think we have made enormous progress in the last decades in realizing that it is inappropriate for government to espouse certain kinds of views of the good life. But on the other side of this, when we have a situation such as we have in our schools, I mentioned this in an earlier lecture, where a teacher cannot even tell a sixth grade pupil that it is morally wrong to be sexually active, I think we ought to have our heads examined. A society that cannot with conviction tell a sixth grade child that it's wrong to be sexually active is a society in very, very deep trouble. And I think a society that is epistemologically very confused. Now, the other side of that, and I'll close with this, is that I think the campaigns Just Say No aren't going to work very well either. They have worked to some extent in terms of alcohol and drugs, but the whole area of human sexuality is far more complex than alcohol and drugs. And I think the danger of being too negative in these areas is that there is the danger of cutting students off, children off, from the very, very positive views of what marriage and human sexuality and so on can entail. So that I think essentially the message to children ought to be, this is worth waiting for, and that at in the sixth grade you simply are too young for this kind of activity. I wouldn't limit it to the sixth grade. I think that's true of kids throughout the middle and even high school. Okay, that does sound rather more like a sermon than even most of my lectures, and some of you think they already sound like sermons, but I think there's no point in my teaching a course like this if I don't tell you what I really think, and I want you to discuss it in sections and go over some of these ideas. I see Jim smiling. You're going to have a fun time in section. Thank you.